Yes. Oh, yes. Richard looks at him. How did that feel?
I felt, he said, irritated. It seemed a waste, I suppose, to come so far, to cross the sea, to die for. He shrugs. God knows why.
Richard says, every day I light a candle for my father.
Does that help you?
No, I just do it.
Does he know you do it?
I can't imagine what he knows. I know the living must comfort each other.
This comforts me, Richard Cromwell.
Richard gets up, kisses his cheek. Good night. Kuskandawl.
Sleep well. It is the familiar form for those who are close to home. It is the usage for fathers, for brothers. It matters what name we choose, what name we make. The people lose their name who lie dead on the field of battle. The ordinary corpses of no lineage, with no herald to search for them, and no chantry, no perpetual prayers. Morgan's bloodline won't be lost, he's sure of it, though he died in a busy year for death, when London was never out of black. He touches his throat, where the medal would have been, the holy medal that Cat gave him. His fingers are surprised not to find it there. For the first time he understands why he took it off and slid it into the sea. It was so that no living hand could take it. The waves took it, and the waves have it still. The chimney at Esher continues to smoke. He goes to the Duke of Norfolk, who is always ready to see him, and asks him what is to be done about the Cardinal's household. In this matter, both dukes are helpful. Nothing is more malcontent, says Norfolk, than a masterless man. Nothing more dangerous. Whatever one thinks of the Cardinal of York, he was always well served. Prefer them to me. Send them in my direction. They will be my men. He directs a searching look at Cromwell, who turns away, knows himself coveted, wears an expression like an heiress, sly, coy, cold. He's arranging a loan for the Duke. His foreign contacts are less than excited. The Cardinal down, he says, the Duke has risen like the morning sun, and sitteth at Henry's right hand. Tommaso, they say, seriously, you are offering what as guarantee? Some old Duke who may be dead tomorrow, they say he is choleric. You are offering a dukedom security in that barbaric island of yours, which is always breaking out into civil war, and another war coming, if your wilful king will set aside the emperor's aunt and install his whore as queen. Still, he'll get terms somewhere. Charles Brandon says, you here again, Master Cromwell, with your lists of names. Is there anyone you specially recommend to me? Yes, but I'm afraid he's a man of a lowly stamp, and more fit that I should confer with your kitchen steward. No, tell me, says the Duke. He can't bear suspense. It's only the hearths and chimneys man. Hardly a matter for your grace. I'll have him, I'll have him, Charles Brandon says. I like a good fire. Thomas More, the Lord Chancellor, has put his signature first on all the articles against Wolsey. They say one strange allegation has been added at his behest. The Cardinal is accused of whispering in the King's ear and breathing into his face. Since the Cardinal has the French pox, he intended to infect our monarch. When he hears this, he thinks, imagine living inside the Lord Chancellor's head. Imagine writing down such a charge, and taking it to the printer, and circulating it through the court and through the realm, putting it out there to where people will believe anything. Putting it out there to the shepherds on the hills, to Tyndale's ploughboy, to the beggar on the roads, and the patient beast in its byre or stall. Out there to the bitter winter winds, and to the weak early sun, and the snowdrops in the London gardens. It is a wan morning. low unbroken cloud. The light filtering sparely through glass is the colour of tarnished pewter. How brightly coloured the king is, like the king in a new pack of cards. How small his flat blue eye. There is a crowd of gentlemen around Henry Tudor. They ignore his approach. Only Harry Norris smiles, gives him a polite good morning. At a signal from the king, the gentlemen retire to a distance, bright in their riding cloaks. It is a hunting morning. They flutter, eddy, cluster. They whisper one to the other and conduct a discourse in nods and shrugs. The king glances out of the window. "So," he says, "how is..." He seems reluctant to name the cardinal. "He cannot be well till he has your majesty's favour."
44 charges, the king says. 44, master.
"Saving your majesty, there is an answer to each one, and given a hearing, we would make them."
"Could you make them here and now?"
"If your majesty would care to sit."
"I heard you were a ready man.
Would I come here unprepared?" He has spoken almost without thinking. The king smiles, that fine curl of the red lip. He has a pretty mouth, almost like a woman's. It is too small for his face.
"Another day I'd put you to the test," he says. "But my Lord Suffolk is waiting for me. Would the cloud lift, do you think? I wish I'd gone out before mass."
"I think it'll be clear," he says. "A good day to be chasing something."
"Master Cromwell!"
The king turns, he looks at him astonished.
"You are not of Thomas More's opinion, are you?"
He waits. He cannot imagine what the king is going to say.
"La chasse! He thinks it barbaric."
"Oh, I see. No, your majesty, I favour any sport that's cheaper than battle. It's rather that... how can he put it? In some countries they hunt the bear, and the wolf, and the wild boar. We once had these animals in England, when we had our great forests."
"My cousin France has bought a hunt. From time to time he says he will ship me some, but I feel..."
"You feel he is taunting you?"
"We usually say..."
Henry looks straight at him.
"We usually say, we gentlemen, that the chase prepares us for war, which brings us to a sticky point, Master Cromwell."
"It does indeed," he says, cheerful.
"You said in the Parliament some 6 years ago that I could not afford a war."
"It was 7 years, 1523. And how long has this audience lasted? 7 minutes? 7 minutes, and he is sure already. There's no point backing off. Do that, and Henry will chase you down. Advance, and he may just falter." He says, "No ruler in the history of the world has ever been able to afford a war. They're not affordable things. No prince ever says, 'This is my budget, so this is the kind of war I can have.' You enter into one, and it uses up all the money you've got, and then it breaks you and bankrupts you."
"When I went into France in the year 1513, I captured the town of Terouin, which in your speech you called..."
"A doghole, Majesty."
"A doghole," the king repeats. "How could you say so?"
He shrugs. "I've been there." A flash of anger.
"And so have I, at the head of my army. Listen to me, master. You said I should not fight because the taxes would break the country. What is the country for but to support its prince in his enterprise?"
"I believe," I said, "saving your majesty, we didn't have the gold to see you through a year's campaign, or the bullion in the country would be swallowed by the war. I have read there was a time when people exchanged leather tokens for want of metal coins. I said we would be back to those days."
"You said I was not to lead my troops. You said if I was taken, the country couldn't put up the ransom. So what do you want? You want a king who doesn't fight? You want me to huddle indoors like a sick girl?"
"That would be ideal, for fiscal purposes." The king takes a deep, ragged breath. He's been shouting. Now, and it's a narrow thing, He decides to laugh.
You advocate prudence? Prudence is a virtue. But there are other virtues that belong to princes.
Fortitude.
Yes, cross that out.
It doesn't mean courage in battle.
Do you read me a lesson?
It means fixity of purpose. It means endurance. It means having the strength to live with what constrains you. Henry crosses the room, stamp, 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 in his riding boots. He is ready for la chasse. He turns, rather slowly, to show His Majesty to better effect, wide and square and bright.
We will pursue this. What constrains me?
The distance, he says. The harbours, the terrain, the people, the winter rains and the mud. When Your Majesty's ancestors fought in France, whole provinces were held by England. From there we could supply, we could provision. Now that we have only Calais, how can we support an army in the interior? The king stares out into the silver morning. He bites his lip. Is he in a slow fury, simmering, bubbling to boiling point? He turns and his smile is sunny.
I know, he says. So when we next go into France, we will need a sea coast.
Of course. We need to take Normandy or Brittany, that's all.
Well reasoned, the king says. I bear you no ill will. Only I suppose you have no experience in policy or the direction of a campaign.
He shakes his head.
None. You said, before I mean, in the speech of yours to the Parliament, that there was £1 million in gold in the realm.
I gave a round figure.
But how would you find that figure?
I trained in the Florentine banks and in Venice. The king stares at him.
Howard said you were a common soldier.
That too.
Anything else?
What would Your Majesty like me to be? The king looks him full in the face. A rare thing with him. He looks back. It is his habit.
Master Cromwell, your reputation is bad.
He inclines his head.
You don't defend yourself.
Your Majesty is able to form his own opinion.
I can. I will.
At the door, the guards part their spears, the gentlemen step aside and bow. Suffolk pounds in, Charles Brandon. He looks too hot in his clothes.
You ready?
He says to the king.
Oh, Cromwell,
he grins.
How's your fat priest?
The king flushes with displeasure. Brandon doesn't notice.
You know, he chuckles, they say the cardinal once rode out with his servant and checked his horse at the head of a valley, where looking down he saw a very fair church and its lands about. He says to his servant, Robin, who owns that? I would that were my benefice. Robin says, it is, my lord, it is.
His story meets with poor success. But he laughs at it himself. He says, my lord, they tell that story all over Italy, of this cardinal or that. Brandon's face falls.
What? Same story?
Mutatis mutandis. The servant isn't called Robin. The king meets his eye. He smiles. Leaving, he pushes past the gentleman. And who should he meet but the king's secretary?
Good morning, he says.
He doesn't often repeat things, but the moment seems to call for it. Gardiner is rubbing his great blue hands together.
Cold, no,
he says.
And how was that, Cromwell? Unpleasant, I think?
On the contrary, he says. Oh, and he's going out with Suffolk. You'll have to wait. He walks on, but then turns. There is a pain like a dull bruise inside his chest. Gardiner, can't we drop this?
No,
Gardiner says. His drooping eyelids flicker.
No, I don't see that we can.
Fine, he says. He walks on. He thinks you wait. You may have to wait a year or two, but you just wait. Isha, 2 days later. He's hardly through the gateway when Cavendish comes hurtling across the courtyard. Master Cromwell, yesterday the king...
Calmly, George, he advises.
Yesterday, he sent us 4 cartloads of furnishings. Come and see. Tapestry, plate, bed hangings. Was it by your suit?
Who knows? He hadn't asked for anything directly. If he had, he'd have been more specific. Not that hanging, but this hanging, which my lord likes. He likes goddesses, rather than virgin martyrs. So away with St. Agnes, and let's have Venus in a grove. My lord likes Venetian glassware. Take away these battered silver goblets.
He looks contemptuous as he inspects the new stuff.
Only the best for you boys from Putney, Wolsey says. It is possible, he adds, almost apologizing, that what the king appointed for me was not in fact what was sent, that inferior substitutions were made by inferior persons.
That is entirely possible, he says.
Still, even so, we are more comfortable for it.
The difficulty is, Cavendish says, we need to move. This whole house needs to be scrubbed out and aired.
True, the cardinal says. St. Agnes, bless her, would be knocked over by the smell of the privies.
So will you make suit to the king's council?
He sighs. George, what is the point? Listen, I'm not talking to Thomas Howard. I'm not talking to Brandon. I'm talking to him. The cardinal smiles. A fat, paternal beam. He is surprised, as they thrash out a financial settlement for the cardinal, at Henry's grasp of detail. Wolsey has always said that the king has a fine mind, as quick as his father's, but more comprehensive. The old king grew narrow as he aged. He kept a hard hand on England. There was no nobleman he did not hold by a debt or bond, and he said frankly that if he could not be loved, he would be feared. Henry has a different nature. But what is it? Wolsey laughs and says, I should write you a handbook. But as he walks in the gardens of the little lodge at Richmond, where the king has allowed him to remove, the cardinal's mind becomes clouded. He talks about prophecies, and about the downfall of the priests of England, which he says is foretold and will now happen. Even if you don't believe in omens, and he doesn't personally, he can see the problem. For if the cardinal is guilty of a crime in asserting his jurisdiction as legate, are not all those clerics from bishops downwards who assented to his legacy also guilty? He can't be the only person who's thinking about this. But mostly his enemies can't see past the cardinal himself, his vast scarlet presence on the horizon. They fear it will loom up again, ready for revenge.
These are bad times for proud prelates, says Brandon, when next they meet. He sounds jaunty, a man whistling to keep his courage up. We need no cardinals in this realm.
And he, the cardinal says, furious, he, Brandon, when he married the king's sister out of hand, when he married her in the first days of her widowhood, knowing the king intended her for another monarch, his head would have been parted from his body if I, a simple cardinal, had not pleaded for him to the king.
I, a simple cardinal.
And what excuse did Brandon make?
The cardinal says.
Oh, your majesty, your sister Mary cried. How she did cry and beg me to marry her myself. I never saw a woman cry so. So he dried her tears and got himself up to a dukedom. And now he talks as if he's held his title since the Garden of Eden. Listen, Thomas, if men of sound learning and good disposition come to me, as Bishop Tunstall comes, as Thomas More comes, and plead that the church must be reformed, why then I listen. But Brandon, to talk about proud prelates? What was he? The king's horsekeeper. And I've known horses with more wit.
My lord, Cavendish pleads, be more temperate. And Charles Brandon, you know, was of an ancient family, a gentleman born.
Gentleman, he? A swaggering braggart, that's Brandon.
The cardinal sits down, exhausted.
My headaches, he says. Cromwell, go to court and bring me better news.
Day by day, he takes his instructions from Wolsey at Richmond and rides to wherever the king is. He thinks of the king as a terrain into which he must advance with no sea coast to supply him. He understands what Henry has learned from his cardinal, his floating diplomacy, his science of ambiguity. He sees how the king has applied this science to the slow, trackless, dubious ruin of his minister. Every kindness, Henry matches with a cruelty, some further charge or forfeiture, till the cardinal moans,
I want to go away.
Winchester, he suggests to the dukes, my lord cardinal is willing to proceed to his palace there.
What, so near the king? Brandon says. We are not fools to ourselves, Master Cromwell.
Since he, the cardinal's man, is with Henry so often, rumours have run all over Europe that Wolsey is about to be recalled. The king is cutting a deal, people say, to have the church's wealth in exchange for Wolsey's return to favour. Rumours leak from the council chamber, from the privy chamber. The king does not like his new set-up. Norfolk is found ignorant. Suffolk is accused of having an annoying laugh. He says, My lord won't go north. He's not ready for it.
But I want him north, Howard says. Tell him to go. Tell him Norfolk says he must be on the road and out of here. Or, and tell him this, I will come where he is, and I will tear him with my teeth.
My lord, he bows, may I substitute the word bite? Norfolk approaches him. He stands far too close. His eyes are bloodshot. Every sinew is jumping. He says,
Substitute nothing, you misbegotten.
The Duke stabs a forefinger into his shoulder.
You person,
he says, and again,
You nobody from hell. You horse-born, you cluster of evil. You lawyer.
He stands there, pushing away like a baker pressing the dimples into a batch of manchet loaves. Cromwell's flesh is firm, dense, and impermeable. The ducal finger just bounces off. Before they left Esher, one of the cats that had been brought in to kill the vermin gave birth to a litter in the cardinal's own rooms. What presumption in an animal! But wait, new life in the cardinal's suite. Could that be an omen? One day he fears there will be an omen of another sort. A dead bird will fall down that smoking chimney, and then, oh, woe is us. He'll never hear the last of it. But for the while the cardinal is amused, and puts the kittens on a cushion in an open chest, and watches as they grow. One of them is black and hungry, with a coat like wool and yellow eyes. When it is weaned, he brings it home. He takes it from under his coat, where it has been sleeping, curled against his shoulder. Gregory, look. He holds it out to his son.
I am a giant. My name is Marlinspike.
Gregory looks at him, wary, puzzled. His glance flinches. His hand pulls away. The dogs will kill it, he says. Marlinspike goes down to the kitchen, to grow stout and live out his beastly nature. There is a summer ahead, though he cannot imagine its pleasures. Sometimes when he's walking in the garden, he sees him, a half-grown cat, lolling watchful in an apple tree, or snoring on a wall in the sun. Spring, 1530. Antonio Bonvisi, the merchant, invites him to supper at his fine tall house on Bishopsgate. I won't be late, he tells Richard, expecting that it will be the usual tense gathering, everyone cross and hungry, for even a rich Italian with an ingenious kitchen cannot find 100 ways with smoked eel or salt cod. The merchants in Lent miss their mutton and malmsey, their nightly grunt in a feather bed with wife or mistress.
From now till Ash Wednesday, their knives will be out for some cutthroat intelligence, some mean commercial advantage. But it is a grander occasion than he thought. The Lord Chancellor is there, amongst a company of lawyers and aldermen. Humphrey Monmouth, whom Moore once locked up, is seated well away from the great man. Moore looks at his ease, holding the company captive with one of his stories about that great scholar Erasmus, his dear friend. But when he looks up and sees him, Cromwell, he falls silent halfway through a sentence. He casts his eyes down, and an opaque and stony look grows on his face.
"Did you want to talk about me?" he asks. "You can do it while I'm here, Lord Chancellor. I have a thick skin."
He knocks back a glass of wine and laughs.
"Do you know what Brandon is saying? He can't fit my life together, my travels. The other day he called me a Jewish peddler."
"And was that to your face?"
his host asks politely.
"No, the king told me. But then my Lord Cardinal calls Brandon a horsekeeper."
Humphrey Monmouth says,
"You have the entree these days, Thomas. What do you think now you are a courtier?"
There are smiles around the table, because, of course, the idea is so ridiculous, the situation so temporary. Moore's people are city people, no grander. But he is sui generis, a scholar and a wit. And Moore says,
"Perhaps we should not press the point. There are delicate issues here. There is a time to be silent."
An elder of the Draper's Guild leans across the table and warns, his voice low,
"Thomas Moore said, when he took his seat, that he won't discuss the Cardinal or the lady either."
He, Cromwell, looks around at the company. "The King surprises me, though, what he will tolerate."
"From you," Moore says.
"I mean Brandon. They're going to hunt. He walks in and shouts, 'Are you ready?'"
"Your master, the Cardinal, found it a constant battle," Bonvisi says, "in the early years of the reign, to stop the king's companions becoming too familiar with him."
"He wanted only himself to be familiar," Moore suggests. "Though, of course, the king may raise up whom he will."
"Up to a point, Thomas," Bonvisi says. There is some laughter.
"And the king enjoys his friendships. That is good, surely."
"A soft word from you, Master Cromwell."
"Not at all," Monmouth says. "Master Cromwell is known as one who does everything for his friends."
"I think," Moore stops. He looks down at the table.
"In all truth, I'm not sure if one can regard a prince as a friend."
"But surely," Bonvisi says, "you've known Henry since he was a child."
"Yes. But friendship should be less exhausting. It should be restorative, not like..."
Moore turns to him, for the first time, as if inviting comment.
"I sometimes feel it is like Jacob wrestling with the angel."
"And who knows," he says, "what that fight was about?"
"Yes. The text is silent, as with Cain and Abel, who knows?"
He senses a little disquiet around the table, among the more pious, the less sportive, or just those keen for the next course. What will it be?
Fish! "When you speak to Henry," Moore says, "I beg you, speak to the good heart, not the strong will."
He would pursue it, but the aged draper waves for more wine and asks him,
"How's your friend Stephen Vaughan? What's new in Antwerp?"
The conversation is about trade, then. It is about shipping, interest rates. It's no more than a background hum to unruly speculation. If you come into a room and say, "This is what we're not talking about," it follows that you're talking about nothing else. If the Lord Chancellor weren't here, it would be just import duties and bonded warehouses. We would not be thinking of the brooding Scarlet Cardinal, and our starved Lenten minds would not be occupied by the image of the king's fingers creeping over a resistant, quick-breathing and virginal bosom. He leans back and fixes his gaze on Thomas More.